All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. As promised, we are going to be shifting our focus to a couple more company-specific interviews here to wrap up the weekend show, simply because, as I said, we are starting to see some much more positive moves in the precious metals stocks. In this segment, we're going to be talking silver and Silvercrest Metals with Chris Ritchie, the president of Silvercrest Metals, traded on the TSX under the symbol SIL and on the NYSE under the symbol SILV. Chris, before we get into some of the recent news and some macro comments on the general markets, I think we do have to start with a general construction update on the Las Chispas project. Last time we chatted, the company was still on time and on budget. And by saying on time, it sounds like the mine should be completed in terms of construction in the fairly near term. I do want to follow up with you, though, because we keep on hearing about inflation, supply chain issues, all these other issues that can impact some construction on a wide range of aspects, but especially on a mining project. How is construction going right now, Chris? What can you tell us?
Yeah, thanks, guys. We're chugging along. You're going to see a piece of news from us probably in the next 2-3 weeks about the Q1 construction update. And for everyone's benefit, at the end of the year, we're on time, on budget. And so far, it looks as if we're still in that realm. We were quite conservative with how we financed the project. And I think, you know, by the skin of our teeth, we started everything, locked in our contract, locked in our costs, did as much as we could to get ahead of a lot of these inflationary problems. So I wouldn't be surprised if we're done construction in the month of May and then are in a position to start ramping up in June onwards. And I think it's quite reasonable if we were to have somewhere between $40 to $50 million US of extra capital at the end of the construction process to be a nice buffer and hopefully proving that we were quite conservative with how we financed the project to date.
Well, Chris, let's look at the balance sheet of the company then, and if you will have any extra buffer at the end of this, and you know, what do you anticipate when things actually get into production? How will the cash flows and revenues start coming in?
There's a few dynamics to note. So again, we're hoping to have that extra buffer of cash. We will have approximately $90 million of drawn debt. We'll see if we draw some more to take a buffer or whatnot through the ramp up or not, and then which is $90 million drawn to date. And then we do have the extra component of value add tax that we pay to the government that does come back to us with a lag time to it, usually about a year and a half. And that total quantity is about $50 million. So there's a few moving pieces that we're still not quite out of the risk category yet. But, you know, as that risk starts to come down, they turn into nice little bonuses. And that bonus, again, is $50 million coming back to us over some period of time we're not totally clear on. Starting that cash flow scenario. And again, if you look in our presentation, we talk about the feasibility study and we use project level free cash flow. And I'll use conservative numbers, let other people look at, you know, be more aggressive. But at $19 silver and $1,500 gold, we're supposed to have about $160 million of project level free cash flow. And when I say project, you have to subtract your G&A and exploration. So let's assume it's somewhere between 30 and 40. So you're, you know, about 120, 110 and 120 million of corporate level free cash flow. Now, a couple little adjustments there. We're going to put out a new study. You know, we'll see when all that gets done. The same team doing the study is the same team doing the ramp up. So we're going to be focused on the ramp up before the study. But the details that will come out there, we're probably going to have higher costs just like everybody else, because when we did the study, some of those numbers will be 2 years old. So there'll be some adjustments on that. But again, that's using $19 silver and $1,500 gold. So on an absolute basis, our high grade and low costs really stand out. In the same study, we also look at the scenario if silver was at 27 and change silver and 1950 gold. So you're pretty close to spot. Silver's a little lower today. And that number contemplated over $200 million of project level free cash flow. So again, subtract your G&A and subtract your exploration. So you could be in a pretty hefty free cash flow situation, not only at today's prices, but even at lower prices. So again, it's something that's quite different from the peer group. If you were to take a comp table from RBC, Scotia, and BMO, the average operating costs for most of the senior assets are in the $18 an ounce range. So again, these are projects that made it. They're sort of the typically the cream of the crop that made it through. Some obviously have lower costs, but it just shows you that there's not a lot of margin even in today's gold and silver price environment.
That's a pretty interesting and very important comment for people to understand, because a lot of investors have been saying, well, with these higher prices, these companies must be making so much more money, but you do need to factor in these higher costs. Chris, I do just want you to elaborate real quick on, you talked about the debt currently at $90 million. You said you still have room if you do need to take out more debt or use that credit facility a bit more. How much more room is still left on that credit facility for you guys?
We've got $30 million left, and we either choose to take it at the end of July or we lose access to it. That was just the terms there. So we'll work on refinancing that debt. But as I said, we're working on a new study and incorporating some of the new drilling and things like that just to get greater clarity. So, you know, the lenders might need to see that come out before that becomes reasonable or not. So that's why having that extra $40, $50 million at the end of construction is quite nice. And that, you know, that does not include the revenue that we'll hopefully start having in the back half of this year. So again, hoping there's quite a comfortable buffer to give people comfort to start taking a peek at the company again.
Well, Chris, you mentioned drilling there. I think it would be nice to get a quick recap of what's been going on at your El Picacho drill results that were just released to the market. This is, just as a reminder for listeners, about 85 kilometers by road northeast of the Las Chispas project that we've been discussing. So are you looking at this as more of a satellite deposit that would feed the beast here as you get things going, or you know, just walk us through what the general plan is for the El Picacho target?
Sure. So, I mean, for people who know the history, I mean, Eric, our CEO, he's a bit of a Jedi on the geology side. So he bought Santa Elena for about $4 million, got a resource, put it into production. You know, at the peak value after we sold the first Majestic, it was worth about $1 billion. You know, Las Chispas was about a $5 million purchase, and here we are today. We paid about $2.5 million for Picacho. So I think first and foremost, it's something that we like to be very prudent with the money we pay. So hopefully it's low risk and high reward. So there's some compliance challenges with trying to connect projects to other projects and whatnot. So we can't sort of make that connection. But what I would sort of highlight is that, you know, Eric and Rosie really understand the geology in the region, and that, you know, the hurdle rate for success, you know, for us to have a project nearby is something that we'd think about, obviously, that would be important. But it is also just important to state at this stage, it's early days. There was a historic resource on the property. And one of the first things we decided to do was kind of drill off that unconfirmed historic resource to learn as much as we could, just to apply whatever we could learn there as we looked at poking around on the rest of the project. So to tie in, like, what we're doing now in the growth drilling is, for the last two and a half years, we've been really focused on infill drilling the ounces we have, increasing our confidence, working with our, you know, engineering operations team to really understand the dilution, the cost for underground development, where it's going to go in a mine plan. So a big majority of our work now is still going to be support that operations team, really make sure that we're nailing the ramp up here, because that's by far the most important thing. But as that work kind of comes to a close, which we're still poking around on that front, it's getting back to that growth, right? So the work yesterday that we released yesterday is us starting that process down for growth. And at Las Chispas itself, doing work on supporting and helping out that operations team and getting clarity for the mine plan and whatnot. But it is also doing mapping and sampling and really trying to figure out what are those next set of targets, so that we can really make use of the infrastructure that's in place right here, right? Because that's the big cost, you know, once that's built. So yeah, the focus is going to be getting back to growth as we kind of work through the ramp up in the early stage of the mine plan.
Chris, can you just recap the drill results that were released in that news? Because it was just over 57,000 meters that was released. One thing that stood out to me is that the project, at least through those drill results, seemed almost more gold dominant. What can you tell us, your takeaway from those meters that were drilled and now released?
Sure. And I want to make sure people understand the difference. When you're starting with an early stage project, you're trying to learn. So the cutoff grade that we would use is much lower. It's like 0.5 meter or 0.5 grams gold. And it was 150 grams a ton. You're trying to understand geologically where the gold and silver might be, right? So again, making the real strong disclaimer out there that anything you're seeing here is before dilution, you know, before capping, understanding what that economic grade is required to get that understanding. So again, you know, there's a big difference between a resource ounce and a reserve ounce, and we're still working on resource ounces. So that's the first step of just sort of the clarity and risk management there. But yes, so far it does look to be predominantly gold. The ground material is quite good, fairly near surface. The property itself is pretty significant in size. It's you know, kind of two or three times the size of Las Chispas. There are several vein packages on the property, and this one was just mainly, this news release was mainly focused on the, you know, the Picacho main vein and some of the hanging wall, footwall, just in and around that area. So again, very early days, because again, the predominant work was on sort of supporting the mine plan. So we're encouraged. The grades are definitely lower than Las Chispas. I mean, like, you're not going to get many companies or assets that are grades are higher, but it is something where, again, we refer to the cost we paid for it. We refer to, you know, Eric and the team understand the geology in the air and the area quite well. So we're hoping people look at it as an early stage project with hopefully far lower risk thresholds and hopefully much greater upside potential.
Well, just one more comment on it, Chris. I mean, your discovery cost, it may not be just as great as Las Chispas, but Las Chispas is world class. What will the next steps be at El Picacho? What kind of drilling following up on this that you have done do you have on slate for the rest of the year?
Sure. So, I mean, the exploration team, priority number one is just doing all the work we need to do to support the operations team, right? So if, you know, you always want to have a really clear understanding of what you're looking at from the underground. So number one priority is going to be support the team, because after all this work for the last 7 years, that's front and center. Keep your head down and work on that. So all the human resources are going to make sure that's number one. Mapping and sampling for both Las Chispas and Picacho, right? We want to make sure that, you know, the most optimal targets are identified and we put them in the appropriate pecking order, so that when we are spending money, it's things that we think will have the biggest bang for the buck, as Rosie likes to say, as well as the most capitally efficient. So I say what you're going to see is we got to go back to the basics. We got to make sure we're which areas can we learn the most about and which ones are going to have the greatest impact. So, and that means we got to go back to, you know, step one, and that's mapping, sampling, picking those targets, and then just balancing the amount of money we're going to spend with just the ramp up, right? We want to make sure everything gets off smoothly. You know, the cash flow is in hand. We don't want to pat ourselves on the back too soon. There's still a lot of risk. So we want to make sure we get out of the gates in a healthy way before we start spending money with debt capital, right? I mean, it's still expensive money that way. So we're going to be a little prudent. We're trying to be a little patient. I know the market isn't always as patient, but the idea is let's get some comfort on the ramp up. Let's make sure the money's flowing in. We've got a clear visibility of getting that debt under control quickly. And then once that freedom of the capital situation frees up, then we can kind of put the foot on the gas again.
All right, Chris, I think that covers both the construction update, although it sounds like when the next news release comes out, we can dive a bit more into that, and the exploration that has happened and will be ongoing. Let's talk a little more macro, but before we get to simply the markets, the company has a slide in your presentation, slide 14, that breaks down how cost inflation impacts low cost versus higher cost silver producers. I will post a link within the weekend show posting to the company's presentation, but I'll let you break down what you're trying to show here, Chris, in terms of how much inflation can impact already producing assets.
Yeah, we had a really good constructive board meeting recently, and one of the things we wanted to discuss was how best to allocate capital in this industry. And we're very fortunate in that what we did is we looked at all of the costs, our exploration, our capital costs, our estimated operating costs, put some inflation on those numbers, the closure of the mine cost, the G&A. We added all up and we want to go, what's our true cost per ounce? Not just the operating, the true cost per ounce. And we're in the neighborhood of about $15. And, you know, on an operating basis, you know, we're hoping that the new study we come out is going to be somewhere between, you know, $8 and $9. And there's a bit of a misunderstanding in the market that, ooh, you can buy a high cost asset. If gold and silver go higher, you're really going to make like really strong leverage. And that might be the case for the stock, right? Really highly sensitive stocks might move more aggressively than low cost assets, but it doesn't mean that's necessarily the case fundamentally. So again, if everyone takes a peek at the slide that Corey's referring to in the presentation, what we did is we took 100 million ounces of silver and we took three hypothetical assets. And we said each one was going to produce 10 million ounces a year for 10 years. And the only difference between the three is one had $10 all-in sustaining costs, one had 15, and one had 20. So again, Las Chispas is clearly closer to the $10 range, and most of the assets are probably closer to the $20 range. And one thing that's very atypical is for people to count on inflation. We talk about inflation all day long for gold and silver, but people don't put those numbers in their models. So what we wanted to show everybody was that, well, how sensitive is the net present value of a company, how you value the company based on these inflationary changes. So again, in the slide, I'll show that if you assumed 5% cost increases per year over that 10-year period of time, the asset starting at $10 an ounce, well, the net present value gets hit by 16%. So yeah, that stings a little bit. The asset starting at $15 an ounce, the net present value comes down by 35%. And the one starting at $20 per ounce, 5% inflation a year for 10 years, the net present value gets hit by 66%. So again, one of the biggest pushbacks that Silvercrest used to get in the early days is, oh, you're kind of expensive. And I used to say back to people as well, we're still growing, right? You know, we're still growing and growing and growing. And we usually kind of find more ounces, we get cheap again, and the stock moves up. Oh, you're expensive. We find more assets, you know, the same thing, kind of repeat, recycle. But people used to say that before we started construction, you know, about a year ago. We're at the same price now as we were when we raised money over a year ago. The difference was we hadn't built the mine. And here we are right at the tail end or at the tag end of mine construction. But with silver actually being lower today than where it was a year ago, but costs are higher, right? Costs are way higher. So the whole point is that the rest of the whole asset class or the universe of potential companies to invest in, those high costs are going to have a way bigger impact on higher cost companies, right? So what I'm trying to highlight and why low cost assets typically deserve a premium is they're far more resilient. And you've heard me talk about this over and over again. We want a company and an asset that can outperform companies in the down market. And that's the low cost, that's the balance sheet. Hopefully the execution kind of comes through smoothly at the end here, and we can say that's part of our story. And at the same time, you know, if costs go up and silver and gold go up in a commensurate way, well, there's not necessarily huge margin expansion for high cost guys. We hopefully will get a greater margin expansion given that our cost profile is lower. So again, this is something that's quite often misunderstood or people don't quite understand that these cost increases everyone's talking about don't necessarily make their way into how companies get valued. It's a bit of a head scratcher to me, but that's why we wanted that conversation on the board. And that's why we want that in the deck. So I think this is something where I think if you think there's going to be inflation for the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, which vehicles are going to be safer for investors to take a peek at? So again, obviously the answer is low cost assets. And hopefully part of the upside we can provide people is, well, we can hopefully still grow from there, right? And grow on top of that. So again, just for people kind of figuring out what better names are in your portfolio, the high cost guys are maybe a little more sexy and you know, a little more Vegas style risk profiles. But for a staple, you know, have it in your portfolio for hedging against, you know, hedging against inflation, low cost assets do a totally different thing in your portfolio.
Well, Chris, I think this is such a major point, and you're right. There's a lot of companies that are not factoring in the inflation metrics into how that's going to affect their economic studies, how that's going to affect their build out, but even for producing operators, how that affects things for them. So I think it's key to highlight it and key to highlight the defensive nature that Silvercrest offers, as well as the offensive side of it, that even if there was a substantial pullback in prices, a lot of companies could not weather that storm. And we kind of saw that in late 2015 and even in that 2020 pandemic crash when a lot of companies' values crashed far worse. And that's because they are so affected by those margins. And one of the reasons I have Silvercrest in my own personal portfolio is for that defensive side of things in case things go awry, but also playing the upside as you guys move from construction into production. But this brings up the inflation question. So I'd love to get your thoughts on You said if inflation lasts 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, people got so used to there being no inflation for decades that that's hard for them to imagine. What is your outlook on inflation, Chris? How are you looking at things, and how are you looking at that balanced with inflation expectations from the marketplace?
Yeah, and that's the beauty of gold and silver performing a few different functions. I mean, I had a chat with Lawrence Leopard yesterday, and he sent me a chart showing that from 1971 till today, the U.S. dollar has lost over 90% of its value versus gold. So, you know, what we've seen is basically close to, you know, 30-35% new supply in the U.S. dollar in the last few years. So right now you're seeing inflation kick up massively. You know, I had a portfolio manager reference that cost labor inflation in Australia for some of the producers was, you know, in the neighborhood of 40%. You're seeing cost increases go up for everything in the supply chain. You know, again, so it's really important to highlight, we're kind of coming through that. All the projects that have yet to build, yet to go through these challenges, yet to release their new studies, yet to have to go finance, have to sort of come clean with those numbers, or the investors are going to have to stomach these potential risks and have to figure out what risk profile they want. The second function of gold and silver is for uncertainty. You know, we now know that Biden's number one priority was to fight inflation. So it was quantitative easing for quite some time. And now it's everyone's talking about tightening. Well, we've had a lot of vodka in the punch bowl for the last umpteen years to support the markets. If everyone's quite openly vocal about trying to pull back and rein in this inflation, that means financial assets that have been the biggest beneficiaries of this money printing, they're at risk. And when the broader market is at risk, gold and silver tends to be a better store of value, financial uncertainty. So it's not just gold and silver performing well because the inflationary nature of things, it's where else do you park your money? And that's the double whammy that I think people, you know, should be kind of contemplating. It's less for speculation. It's more just, how do I protect myself? You know, you still got crazy valuations on a lot of the tech space, non-profitable space. And there was a great article by Richard Bernstein and Associates that talked about the next 10 years is going to be a commodity focused market where people are looking at short duration assets that aren't as sensitive to higher interest rates. Right. So I think the positioning towards commodities hasn't really happened yet. The strategic value of commodities, as we start to talk about deglobalization, hasn't really come through on fund flow yet. So I don't think we either have the strength as the governments of the world to really cool down markets that much, which means inflation's either going to run hot. But if we do have the fortitude to really try to control inflation, well, that means basically the rest of the market is going to be a far riskier place for people's money to be. So again, we're trying to structure a company, a vehicle where people can try to feel a greater degree of confidence. We don't need people having all their net worth in Silvercrest, but you know, for some of these low cost, good balance sheet assets, you know, they are staples in portfolios, and that's what we're trying to create.
Hey, it's all about something. Even commodities finally outperforming the markets, right? But we have started to see that this year. Chris, as much as we talk about commodities doing well, I do want to focus a little bit more on silver, because base metals, energy commodities, they have their own role in that whole commodities complex. Silver, precious metal, also has industrial uses. How do you see this new inflationary environment and the different markets that we're seeing focused more on silver, not just commodities?
So, yeah, well, I referenced, you know, the big, you know, global banks here that focus on mining, that if you look at their comp tables, that the average high quality silver assets around $18 operating cost. And I mentioned that if you put 5% inflation per year, starting at $18 for 10 years, your operating costs go to $27, right? So that's just operating. Now, again, exploration, CapEx, you know, G&A, risks, making a return, taxes, just shows you that if you're a primary silver mine, you're going to need to see $35-$40 an ounce before it makes sense to allocate too much money. We do know a lot of silver does get produced as a byproduct for other copper mines or gold mines. So those numbers I gave you are more for primary silver projects. There's going to be a supply and demand dynamic that occurs as a byproduct. But my main point here is that we need to see a lot higher prices before people are going to start allocating new money. So not only, you know, do we need to see higher prices, people don't have that cost certainty. So, you know, about 60% of silver is consumed. Silver tends to be more volatile than gold. You know, it is a key component and part of this energy transition in the new economy, but you can't turn on supply quickly, right? And the lack of investment over the last decade, as the big boys have been paying down debt and cleaning up their balance sheets and getting to a point where most of them are net positive in terms of their cash balances now, they need to be convinced to go allocate new dollars. And when you start to look at some of the political risk with different countries, the time it's going to take to get that new production in line, there's just this big imbalance for silver in terms of that long-term supply and demand dynamic. And that's the same thing that occurs for nickel and cobalt and copper and a bunch of these things. And the world wants to vilify mining. And that's okay. But, you know, at the same time, all the things we need to transition to electric vehicles, having a grid that can actually sustain electric vehicles, wind turbines, and all the things we need to transition, well, we need all these components. People haven't sort of made that connection that, you know, an electric vehicle company trading at 40 times EV to EBITDA that's treated like a hero actually has to go buy the products that the mining companies are making, and the mining companies are treated like villains. I think you're going to see some sort of reckoning as it relates to where valuation and capital flows. And the fact that you just can't produce more silver cheaply in any short-term time frame just really bodes well. And that's why, again, we want that defense in place. And when we think about upside, we think about it from a 5 or 10 year period of time and really want to build up that upside.
All right, Chris, really appreciate the update on Silvercrest Metals, as well as your thoughts on the general markets, the macro comments here, especially as it involves inflation and how it impacts producers. It's something that I think some people have glossed over a little bit too much, as we mentioned. But if anybody wants more information on what's going on at Silvercrest Metals, please email us either fleck@kereport.com or chat@kereport.com. We will follow up as some more news comes out. And Chris, appreciate you taking the time on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your Easter long weekend.